views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. We're going to have a informative, fun, relaxed, enjoyable program, followed by me an hour later with 2 hours more of space with George Norrie on Coast to Coast. So if any of you want to stay up late and you have Coast to Coast in your area or you know how to get it streaming, and you want to hear even more of my pontifications on commercial space, tune us in 10 to 12 tonight. Bob is certainly a veteran of George Norrie, as am I. I don't expect it to be as in-depth as what we're going to talk about tonight, but it should be a lot of fun. But I'll tell you more about Bob in just a minute. But first, let me do the typical announcements. For those of you who want to call Bob Zimmerman and talk to him, anything space-related, science-related, bat-related is on the table. 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then, of course, you can comment on our blog, which one person already has. I'll read that comment in a little while. And we will get your blog comment, and we can integrate that in with Bob just as quickly as we get it from you. So those are the three ways to reach us tonight. Of course, telephone, toll-free, 1-866-687-7223 is the preferable blue label way to do that. Our website, thespaceshow.com, so do check it out. Our website newsletter is there, center right, and if you scroll down a little bit further than just this week's activity, you'll see all the great programming we have planned through the third quarter of 2017. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website very easily, very fast, where you can download the programs. There is a store, remember, if you're so inclined to want a Space Show t-shirt or a coffee mug or something of that nature, it is in the support menu, upper left, and you'll see the Cafe Press logo wear store. There's also listen live instructions, so many of you do ask, how do you listen to a live show? How do you listen to an archive show? If you go to that upper left menu under listen live, you'll get all of those instructions. And then if you need more help, don't hesitate to email Bob Zimmerman about that. He'll be glad to help you. The most important button there is support the Space Show. And remember, that's also center right. We're a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, giantleapfoundation.org. And because many of you do financially support the program, we're able to bring you the Space Show coming up on 16 years and 3,000 shows. So we thank you for your financial support. Without it, the Space Show would have been history many, many, many years ago. But we're still going, and we thank you for your support. We still need your support. And, you know, if you enjoy the format, if you enjoy the shows, if you really like free content, then help us out and make a PayPal support contribution to us or send us a donation check. Remember, as a nonprofit, you do get a tax deduction for your gift if you're paying federal taxes. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a California tax deduction. We are a public benefit corporation in the Golden State. Visit 1ONEGiantLeapFoundation.org if you have any questions about any of that. We do have sponsors. Well, first, let me tell you that podcasting is available, and you can do that through gigadial.net, or you can do it off of your apps for your smartphones or anything else. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. So if you do have any podcasting questions or problems on your smartphone or anything like that, please do email me, and I'll be glad to help you as best as I can. And then What else can I tell you about our sponsors? Well, we have corporate sponsors, too, and we have a few of them still available for 2017. If you're interested, email me and I'll give you the details. But you get a banner ad running across the website, and you can see the banner ads of our existing sponsors. Click on them from time to time. They have good information in them, and they do update that information from time to time. And then I read a short message from each of our sponsors for the first segment of the show and the second segment of the program. So for the first segment of tonight's program, we have the usual first segment sponsors, if I can find them. And so the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us during the first segment for the most part. This is the detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space, and this plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by the base in an asteroid belt and space settlements. Find out all about it at their website, thespaceplan.com. If you view the plan online, and it's a big poster when you go to it, it's got 500 elements or cells in it, and you can click on those cells. They're all interactive, and you can get a lot more information. So do check that out. You can also buy a copy of the Space Plan poster and put it up on your door, as I have done. It's not interactive when you buy it, but it is a really big, cool, inspiring, full-color poster. All of this is available at the website, thespaceplan.com. Do remember also that the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and I just came back from the 33rd Symposium in Colorado Springs, the first one that I had ever attended. I loved it. I had a great time, even though it snowed one day. The Blue Origin rocket was there, New Shepard. The capsule was there. The lines were too long. I did not go into the capsule, but I did look through the window. The lines were there constantly among all the military people in uniform, everyone. The only time there were no lines there was on the day that it snowed, which I believe was Tuesday, and they covered it in big tarps, the rocket as well as the capsule, during the snowstorm. It snowed at night until about 10 o'clock in the morning, and then they took it out and cleared the snow off. The Broadmoor is really good about that, and they were back in business. So the 34th symposium is April 16th through the 19th of next year. And I would really urge you to go to it as we get closer and closer. I'll tell you more about it. But it was a great event. People that I've never met before, totally different audience, lots and lots of military people. I met the head of space. I actually sat with him at dinner when I heard Congressman Bridenstine talk. And he was the head of the Russian thing in New York, the consulate in New York, but does all the space stuff for Russia. And I forget his name, but he's been sending me emails all the time. I'll probably get investigated by Congress now. But I met really cool people. I met the military brass from Saudi Arabia and the UAE, all sorts of cool stuff. So that's a big 30-second spot for the Space Foundation, but well worth it. And that brings me to our guest tonight. Bob Zimmerman is back. So you're familiar with him. You don't need a big introduction to him. And if you do, then go read the bio on our website. But you should be visiting his website on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day, because he does continue to add to it. And this is behindtheblack.com. And he has all sorts of really fascinating, interesting, and timely space news. But he has other science news and other developments and things that are relevant to space, or probably relevant to your life. So I really recommend that. And Bob is back with us tonight. He's just come back from overseas. It's good to talk to him again. And Bob, I am so happy you're our first guest, because if I knew how to do a drum roll, I would do a drum roll. President Trump says we're going to Mars during his first term.
Yes, that's true. It must be whatever Trump says, we must take seriously. Go nuts over the absurdity of such a serious statement. It was very clearly he was joshing around with the astronauts while he was talking to them at ISS, and he's joshing around in a positive sort of way, but it's an absurdly positive sort
of way. Well, you hope he's joshing around. We hope he isn't really believing that he can go to Mars in his first
time. Yeah, I think that it's, I think that there's a lot of people out there who would love to turn almost anything he says into absurdity and foolishness. And though I will say he does this a lot, he's also a very good manipulator of the press, and he knows exactly how to play those kind of games to get the press to go nuts. And this is another example of it. He likes to generate craziness. I mean, I can tell you, presidents have been calling astronauts on ISS for decades, and they say the typical silliness that no one cares about, like, you're doing great work. Isn't it wonderful?
You're inspiring to all the young kids
and
women.
Stuff, which is very boring. And so Trump, you know, the whole point of a photo op like that or an audio op like that is to generate, as a politician, is to generate excitement and interest. And he's very good at it. And so he knows to say something like that is a little bit silly. But in the direction people want to go, he knows people want to get to Mars sooner rather than later. And so he joshes it in the positive direction. And, of course, his opponents go nuts thinking he's an idiot. And the people who support him, like, scratch their heads and say, well, we'd like to go sooner, but, you know. And all it does is get people to talk about it, as we're doing right now. If you go to Behind the Black, you'll notice there's nothing on Behind the Black about that, because I almost never talk about photo ops, because they are ephemeral. They're ephemera. They don't mean anything. They go away, and nothing has changed from the photo op. It's other things that happen that are much more significant than I pay attention to, and that wasn't one of them.
Well,
and, you know, they make a big deal about Trump liking to post on Twitter. I don't have a Twitter account. I have never gone to Twitter. I pay as little attention to Twitter as I can, because almost everything goes on Twitter is a sewer and stupid and really inappropriate, especially people who try to do intellectual discussions on Twitter. It's, like, absurd. There are purposes where Twitter would be useful, and sometimes that's the case, especially when a breaking news story, you can get a quick picture or video out. But, you know, when people do debates on Twitter, it's like, this is not where you have an intelligent discussion and you're wasting your time. And Trump's posts on Twitter are all done for the same exact reason. He's to generate interest and discussion on issues along the direction he wants them to go. And I don't pay that much attention.
Okay, Bob, we're into, for all practical purposes, May. This is the 25th of April.
Yeah.
My ex-wife's birthday, by the way. What's happening in space? We don't have a NASA, you know, focus or a NASA administrator. We've got rumors, but I don't even know if they're good rumors.
Yeah.
Where are we in your opinion? What's worth focusing on? What's moving forward and impressing you?
Well, it's very clear to me for the last, 8 months since the election, 7 months, that almost everybody in the aerospace industry and in Congress interested in space matters and the money involved with space matters has been putting on a full-court press to try to influence Donald Trump to establish a space policy that would benefit them. You have the big space players, the people who are building SLS and Orion, pushing for a variety of mission statements that they could give to Orion and SLS.
Yeah, new rides for Orion.
There is no plan for Orion. After its first manned mission, there is nothing budgeted and nothing planned. And they've been trying for a long time to try to get Congress to do something. And they think they have an opportunity here with a new president who can do what I like to call the Kennedy-like speech, where he will stand on some pedestal somewhere with some astronauts behind him, and he will say, we should go to Shmekowitz asteroid by the end of this decade and bring them back safely. And they've been doing this for now. Every president practically since Kennedy has been doing this, and practically none of them have gotten accomplished what they promised we would do by the end of whatever decade. But there's a lot of people pushing for this. So the big spaces are pushing for some kind of deep space lunar plan mostly, but some of them are pushing for Mars. NASA's pushing for Mars because it's the farthest goal, it will cost the most, and will take the longest, so they can stretch it out for as long as possible and be a giant. Some people in Congress are doing the same thing. there are some people who are proposing, you know, commercial space, use commercial space. NASA should hire them to do this kind of stuff. And I bring, you know, you're asking me, we're going, no one really knows right now where Donald Trump is going to go. It's very clear that he really thinks space is cool. He's definitely made an effort to, he's had more than enough statements to show he thinks space is cool and he wants something to go on with America in space. But what his actual policy is going to be is somewhat unclear right now. It is clear that that NASA has been, you know, this is what my policy paper, Capitalism in Space, was all about. I was comparing the big space approach that NASA has used since the 60s, where they build everything, where the president gives them a goal, and then they proceed to build something, versus NASA being a customer and buying it from the commercial market. We've had this actually two-pronged approach now for almost a decade, more than a decade, actually. And we can actually compare between the two approaches, which is having more success. And there is a debate very clearly in the Trump administration and in Congress, which approach should we do? Should we do both? Or should we focus on one? And, of course, the question of where the most poor can go to the most places becomes a factor in this. And you know, and we don't know where Trump is on this either, because he vacillates between go private space and let's save money, and on the other side, hey, I really think a big stimulus budget project where the government spends lots and lots of money will be great for the economy and the nation. He goes back and forth. So it's really very unclear where he's going to go. And everybody, including myself, is trying to influence where he's going to go. I mean, Capitalism in Space was trying to illustrate which way to go. I mean, it very clearly, I'm very clearly in the court, which says you should go with private space. You should stop asking NASA to build almost anything. You should cut NASA down and let private enterprise do the job for NASA and the federal government. That's where I stand. But you know, I had a bunch of op-eds since Capitalism in Space is out, and the most recent one I had, for the Federalist, in which I was arguing that the policy Trump should establish should not be the typical proposing NASA build something. You know, NASA, even if it buys it from the private sector, it's still not the right approach. You know, telling SpaceX, we're going to get to Mars using some private companies competing. That sounds good, but that's really not the right approach in my mind. And similarly, asking NASA to build it with SLS and Orion, that's not the right approach. And I think it comes down to not recognizing what the real purpose of the federal government is. And so I actually was thinking about this, because I have a lot of readers on Behind the Black who were making suggestions on what Trump's policy should be. And it occurred to me that I'm a historian, so I went back into history again, and I looked at what did the federal government do during the 1800s in the United States when we were trying to settle the West. And the federal government there did not have a Western administration program to settle the West. You know, we are going to reach California by the end of this decade. No, they didn't have
it. They didn't do that. No, yeah.
Nobody even proposed it. The federal government did very clearly and actually correctly was it recognized that its job is to establish law and the framework, the legal framework, to make it practical and possible for the citizens to develop and settle the West. And that's what they did. They established law for creating those territories, which became states. Within those territories, they established the legal framework for law enforcement and property rights and education and schools and et cetera, and taxing, the whole ball of wax, the basic framework, legal framework for any society that needed any what any society needs. And from that, the society, the West was settled very efficiently and very effectively in the United States. So I said, well, what should happen in space? Well, one of the biggest obstacles we have in space is the inability of any nation to establish its law in space, because everybody who goes to space is pretty much a signatory to the Outer Space Treaty. And the Outer Space Treaty very specifically outlaws any nation from claiming any territory and establishing its sovereignty. So that's where the problem is. And that's when I said, if Trump wants to really set a policy that's going to have a legacy, that's going to really change the future, what he should focus on is he should, let's change the Outer Space Treaty. Let's establish a system and a legal framework where nations can claim territory, in which they, you know, in a framework that would work and, you know, allow all nations to have the opportunity to get into space and make a claim. And once that claim is made, then U.S. law can, and Chinese law and Russian law and European law can be applied to the claims, to the territories. And so we could have a Homestead Act where people can, you know, a mining company can claim a piece of land and then they own the rights to it and they have legal solidity. And, you know, private tourist companies can build a hotel and know they're going to own that hotel. And so that's where I think Trump should go. It would take a really person with real foresight and courage to do it, because it carries less of a pork payoff for all the players in Washington.
Let me stop you, because does, to the best of your knowledge, and I don't know the answer, I'm hoping you do, are there any pro get out of outer space treaty legal advisors that have Trump's ear or key people in the Senate and the House's ear? Is there anyone other than, say, an advocate or
yes.
Someone like that?
Oh, yes.
Who's talking about
yes.
this?
Yes. In fact, this is what was most amazing to me. All right. In writing up this op-ed, I noted how a bunch of countries, the U.S. is the lead in this. They've been, Congress has been struggling with this problem with the Outer Space Treaty for years, coming up with a variety of regulations. In fact, one of the laws we have is actually in direct conflict with the Outer Space Treaty in terms of ownership and mining rights. And because the Constitution says treaties are the supreme law of the land, the law that Congress passed would probably be ineffective. But nonetheless, Congress has been struggling with this. The United Arab Emirates is starting to try to put a policy together. Japan is trying to put a policy together. And I've looked at every one of these. The UK is trying to put a policy together, and Luxembourg is trying to put a policy together. And I looked at each one of them as over the last few months, and every single one of them is struggling with the same problem. Every single one. It's very clear they're trying to set a framework where private or even their enterprise, they will have legal control over it, and they're all finding that under the treaty, they can't really do it. Now, what's interesting is Luxembourg is the biggest player here, because they announced about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, that they were going to get very big into asteroid mining and private enterprise in space. And Luxembourg is an interesting small nation that has a lot of capital, and what the government does with that tax money and that capital is very different from almost any other nation in the world. They treat it like investment capital, and they use it in private enterprise to make money for their citizens and their nation. And they've done that. They have one of the most successful commercial communication satellite companies. SES is one of their companies. SES is a company that has been willing to let SpaceX fly their satellites with reused boosters. They've been very supportive of SpaceX. And that's a Luxembourg. So Luxembourg's been trying to get this going because they want to do asteroid mining. They have been investors with Planetary Research. Now, this is what's interesting. So they're putting trying to put some plan together, and so the guy who's their executive in their government, he's actually the economic director. He puts this plan together, and he submits it to one of their legislative bodies. It's a council of advisors. It's a complicated legislative system they have.
Yeah, the council of state.
Yeah, and so that council looks at his proposal, and a week after my op-ed comes out, they reject it outright.
I've got it up on the website, listeners. I'll put it in the
archives. There's a link on my
archives.
Page, too.
Yeah, and if you want to find it real quick, Google Delano, D-E-L-A-N-O, doubts over space mining legal status.
Yes, and so they rejected it outright, and they rejected it outright because They said this...
No property rights.
It doesn't solve the problem of property rights. We won't have strong legal control over what we're doing. And they then directed the executive guy in charge to go to the UN and say, we need a revision of the Outer Space Treaty to deal with the issue of property rights. Now, this is really pretty much the very first time I've ever seen any government actually address this issue in those terms. We got to go to the get the Outer Space Treaty changed. Now, at the same time, there have been hearings in Congress over the last few months that have been addressing the property rights issue, and they have stated in those hearings, you do a search on Behind the Black on Outer Space Treaty, you'll come across the recent hearings, I think it was the Science Committee in the House, where they were discussing property rights, and they basically kept coming back to the fact that the Outer Space Treaty prevents it, and they don't know how to deal with that. And so this is coming up increasingly, and my position, my feeling on this is that I'm not sure they're going to deal with it now. But I think that inevitably it has to be dealt with. It's inevitable it'll be dealt with. If it isn't dealt with legally on Earth, the people in space are eventually going to tell us to go jump in a lake because they need property rights, and they're going to just revolt because they're not getting their property rights. You can't do it any other way. But I think it's going to come much sooner than that because nations and private companies are going to increasingly recognize they're not, the law doesn't, the treaty doesn't allow the protection of property rights. And so I'm seeing this happening. And I found that there were two different articles in the press within a week of my op-ed talking about this problem. And Luxembourg's actions was very interesting. So I would say right now that are there anyone interested in this? I don't know. There is enough of an interest in the subject and a dilemma. I repeat, the United Arab Emirates is trying to put a law together. Japan just did it. England's trying to do it. The United States has been struggling to do it. Almost every spacefaring country that does private enterprise has been trying to come up with some regulatory framework to allow private investment in space and development. And all of them are faced with the same problem. So, and because they're trying to do it now, I think you're going to begin to get some movement to make it happen. Well, with that basis, this puts a president right now in a position where if he wants to be a leader, he could jump ahead of everybody and really force the issue. And that's what my proposal was. Now, whether Donald Trump will do this or not is a total unknown. I do know that after Capital in Space came out, I have been contacted by a number of people in all levels of the government who want to talk about it because they find it of value and of interest because it provides the numbers and the basic clear in evidence that the old way of doing things is just not working. And the new way of doing things appears to actually be more effective. And the new way is, really, for the United States, is the old way, which is private enterprise, competition, private property, and it's not the government doing it. So are we going to go this way without a space? That's the basic situation right now. I will absolutely, David, readily admit that I think it's unlikely in the near future that any major change is going to happen.
I think part of the problem is, and it doesn't, I go back to our friend Rand Simberg, and that is that there isn't really enough interest in space, and Trump has so many problems and things on his agenda, and with one party out to assassinate him on everything and the media going after him and his own blunders, he's just, I think Rand is right. There's probably just not the interest in space to make it the focal point of trying to get him out of a lot of his dilemmas, which many are you know, self-created, and others are created by others who really detest him.
Yeah, I don't dispute that in the slightest. What I do see happening, though, in the next 5 years, as the increasing pressure comes from competing private companies making a lot of money in space,
should pick
those
it up,
companies
yeah.
are going to be able to start to put pressure on the federal government and government bodies to try to begin to deal with this issue. They're going to have the clout to say, this has got to be dealt with. We can't invest in space, and we want to. And that is usually where Congress and the president start to move when they get pressure from the money donors who are private companies. And so I think that's going to be happening. I mean, we very clearly see there is a real clear shift in the American space program from government to private enterprise. For example, I'm behind the black about 2 months ago. I put together a graph showing the launch history over the last, like, 25 years, you know, the number of launches each year and who put those launches up. And with the United States, because pretty much we're the only ones that have it, I split it up to show the various launches by different companies. Now, this is not focused on what was launched. This is focused on the rockets and the provider of launch services. And what was very interesting with the United States is very clear, and since the shuttle disappeared, we are shifting to a private enterprise model where the government doesn't do the launch anymore. It is a private, we hire the private companies to do the launch for us, and it's shifting in that direction very clearly. And there is also a very clear evidence that the number of launches are beginning to rise, that this is an industry, I think, that's about to break out for a lot of reasons. And that once again brings me back to dealing with the Outer Space Treaty, because it's gone. That kind of success and movement is eventually going to put pressure on people to take action. Now, does this mean it's a major issue? Yeah, I agree with you, it's not. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be dealt with. At some point, there are people in government who focus on these particular issues and want to deal with them, and it becomes their niche. And so I think some of those people in their niche are going to deal with it. Congressmen and senators that have big space industries like Texas and Florida, well, that is their niche. They've got to serve the space community, and the shift to private enterprise is going to put pressure on them to help private enterprise. And that's where the Outer Space Treaty change of that treaty comes.
What do you see coming up from our companies that we love to talk about, Blue and SpaceX, for example?
Well, I mean, in a sense, we're talking about things on this show that are less covered normally. You know, we talk all the time about SpaceX's, reasonable booster successes. I mean, since I was on last, they had probably the most significant rocket launch since the very first rocket launches. They actually launched a satellite, an SES satellite from Luxembourg, by the way, using a used first stage booster, which they then successfully landed again. And they could use it a third time, but they have already announced they're going to put it on display because it's a historic piece of equipment. But they are moving, and SpaceX itself is shifting its whole operation in the direction of less expendable and more reusable, and trying to therefore save money in that manner. For example, I think it's the next Dragon capsule that's launching sometime in the next month. Let's do a quick check exactly when it launches. But that Dragon capsule is not a new capsule. That will be a used capsule that had flown previously. This is the end of May. The end of May is tentatively when it's going to happen, and that capsule is a used capsule. And they have said pretty clearly that they don't want to use new capsules for their cargo missions, that their goal in the very near future, possibly right after this mission, is to have every cargo flight using a used capsule. No new capsules there. And they'd be using the older version of the Dragon capsule for those purposes. They've got plenty of them, and they can reuse them. Meanwhile, they're shifting to the manned craft to, make it, if they can demonstrate that the cargo craft can be reusable, they will be in a position to start maybe reusing the manned craft. SpaceX, Elon Musk, in the exuberance of the success of the first stage, he immediately said, we're not going to start looking at how we can reuse the second stage. It's a more difficult problem. But the way that company functions, which is very smart, is, you got the second stage up in orbit. It has fuel. Often it operates. Why not play with it? Even if you send it back to Earth, you can learn what problems you have to solve to reuse it. And so they're going to start playing those games. And it's, they're going to utilize the equipment they have to learn something about the engineering to make it better. And so that's a major play. That's going to change the whole framework. Ariane Space, the other player, they are moving forward with their main contractor, Airbus Safran, to start the initial construction of the first engineering prototypes of the Ariane 6 rocket. These are going to be ground testing prototypes for the purposes of checking engines and design. But they plan to have that rocket flying by 2020. That rocket is designed to be cheaper to fly and therefore cost competitive. I'm not so sure it's going to be as cost competitive as it needs to be, but they're trying at least. And the same thing happened is going on with ULA. They're struggling very hard to try as a in their corporate culture to try to figure out how to make that company better able to dance on its toes and compete. And Tory Bruno, I think the CEO there, is doing a really fine job in trying to make those changes. It's hard with a corporation to make changes like that, but he's been cutting staff and trying to cut fat aggressively. You know, about 2 years ago, I was going to give a lecture at Vandenberg Air Force Base for the local chapter of the American Institute of Astronautics and Aviation, the AIAA, and their chapter there. And so I went, and when I went, I said they'd give me a tour, and so I took a tour of the base and got to see really close look at ULA's launch facilities. They let me in, and I could see where the Deltas were launched and where the Atlas V's were launched. I didn't have a tour of SpaceX's facility, but I really didn't need a tour of SpaceX's facility. We drove up to the gate, we could look through the gate, and we could see the whole facility. It was just one simple building with a whole bunch of what looked like junk in the yard. It wasn't junk, but, you know, stuff they didn't need to store indoors. They just stuck it outside. There was nobody there. It was very simple. They wasn't doing a launch, so why waste staff sitting around doing nothing? The ULA facilities had large staffs. There was a lot of people hanging around. They had a lot of employees, and they were like a gold-plated operation. And I noted the difference, and I said, well, this is an example of why SpaceX does it so cheaply. Well, interesting enough, Tory Bruno, in the last 6 months, has been cutting staff and doing layoffs. It's not because they're not making money. It's because he's trying to cut costs. And one of the places he cuts significant costs is he's eliminated a lot of jobs at Vandenberg. And I don't celebrate people losing their jobs, but I do celebrate the company realizing, you know, we got fat here. We can operate more efficiently, and let's do it. And, Tory, you know, a lot of companies say, well, we can operate more efficiently, but since no one's asking us to, let's not do it. Well, his attitude was, let's make it more efficient. That makes them competitive. So you've got that going.
He was on an innovation panel at the Space Foundation Symposium, which I attended. I think there were like 14 people on the panel. It was pretty impressive. And he was the superstar. Unbelievable. Yeah, and people kept directing their questions to him, and the moderator is this woman from NASA headquarters, who I would actually like to get on the show. She kept directing the questions to Tory over most of the other people, and not only was he Mr. Charisma and Mr. Personality, you know, he looks kind of like Mr. Clean.
He was
just spectacular. So I went up and talked to him afterwards and ask him if he'd come back on the space show, and I'm working with his office to see if I can bring him back on the show now.
He's really trying very hard to change that company, and I think this is a really good thing.
Yeah, he's a superstar, if you ask me.
Yeah, and it's hard. This is a big corporate culture. That company was incredibly resistant to competition. Its approach to SpaceX's arrival initially with the previous CEO is, we'll put together an advertising lobbying campaign and talk about how wonderful we are, and that'll solve the problem. And thank goodness for that company, the board of directors of ULA said, oh, wait a minute, this ain't going to work. And they fired that guy, literally. They didn't let, you know, they let him go, and they replaced him with Bruno, who has really tried to straighten the situation out. And they are being competitive. All these companies, except for SpaceX, have a serious problem, which is that they have rockets that are not reusable, and they're not designing their rockets for reusability, and they no longer can make the claim that such an idea is impossible or impractical. They've been making that claim for 50 years, but they can't make that claim anymore. And so they're faced with companies that are doing that, and are going to therefore going to be able to provide launch services at significantly less money. And that is a challenge that they're going to have to face. I think that the success of SpaceX with its vertical landing system makes the Vulcan proposal that ULA has, whereby they will bring the engines down safely and reuse them, but not the rest of the first stage. It now is beginning to look increasingly overly complicated and expensive and maybe not the best solution. Whether this company will either prove me wrong or be as open-minded, be open-minded enough to recognize that and change their tact is a question for the future. You got Blue Origin, you know, doing reusability the same way SpaceX
right.
is, basically with their Nucleon rocket. They've already announced this is how they're going to do it. It's going to land on a barge. And since they're building from the beginning with reusability, with vertical landing from the very beginning, SpaceX didn't do that from the very beginning, so they had to do re-engineering to make it work. Well, Nucleon is going to be built that way from the start. And that, in a sense, gives them an advantage over SpaceX in terms of design.
Listeners, and I did forget to tell you that our phone lines are open for those of you who do want to call. They're no longer offline. And the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Anything goes if you want to talk with Bob tonight. And, of course, email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. I have an off-the-beat question from a listener who is concerned about something, but not directly the kind of space stuff we talk about. You want to take one?
Sure, absolutely.
This is Carly in San Diego. And Carly says, I'm a news junkie, not necessarily a space junkie. I would like your honest assessment. I know you probably don't have access to any secret information, but do you think the U.S. has the technology to knock down a North Korean missile?
Well, that's not really a secret. We have defensive missile systems that actually not only can do that, have done it in actual military situations. The Patriot missile system per se was used in Iraq and very successfully was knocking down missile attacks.
But not an ICBM.
Yeah, not ICBMs, but they did it with medium-range missiles and short-range missiles, and I should point out that right now the only thing Korea apparently has is short- and medium-range missiles. Some of that technology was adopted by Israel. They use it on their Iron Dome system very successfully. So do we have such technology? I have no doubt we have. The Air Force, the military has actually done a test mission where they used a missile on the ground to fire and destroy a satellite in orbit. Now, if you can hit a satellite in orbit with a missile, you can hit an ICBM because the satellite is actually moving faster than the ICBM is. And so I actually do not have doubt that we have such technology. That isn't, in the long run, the best solution to North Korea. Unfortunately, the previous administration, and I have been writing about this on Behind the Black, how they kind of like have been making, the previous several administrations, I don't want to just be partisan and say Obama, because the Bush administration was like looking away and making believe there was no issue, and the Clinton administration actually signed a deal which allowed them to start developing this nuclear capability. So the Trump administration is now faced with a threat that they need to deal with. And this is where, you know, focusing on Trump's joshing and silly statements gets you, you know, misdirects your attention from the things he's doing that actually make a great deal of sense. And his approach to North Korea has forced, finally, and I've been puzzling why the Chinese haven't been dealing with this issue, but I think Trump finally forced them to deal with it, and they are now putting incredible pressure on North Korea. Because it's not so much they want to protect us, but they don't want us to move into North Korea because that's moving into their sphere of influence in their minds. So the Chinese, when they realize that Trump is getting serious about moving into their sphere of influence, they realize, well, we better take action first. And so several things they've done that nobody has done a long time ago is they have canceled all coal imports from North Korea. North Korea.
North Korea, right.
That's one of North Korea's biggest financial sources of money, is the coal that they export to China. And they froze that. They sent a whole bunch of ships back to North Korea saying, we don't want it, we're getting it from other places. And in addition to that, they have amassed a large number of troops on the border of North Korea. And they've made it very clear they're there for reasons that are obvious with the news. Now, are they going to invade North Korea? Maybe, maybe not. But what they are doing is trying to put pressure on that main maniacal leader of North Korea to try to get him to
rein it in.
Now, whether he does or not, you can't expect rational behavior from an irrational person. They are very clearly now beginning to address this issue because Trump has applied intelligent pressure on them to do it. And so that's at least dealing with that issue, and that's a more appropriate way to deal with the issue. You don't want to have to stop a missile on the way. You want to prevent the missile from launching. And this is a country led by someone who very clearly has said many times this is what he wants to do, is launch missiles against his neighbors and enemies. Well, that has to be prevented. And that the proper approach isn't to use missile technology to stop it. The proper approach is to stop it at the source. And I think eventually the United States is going to be, or China, or Russia, by the way. They've also massed troops.
They've also put troops over there.
Yeah, so there's really, each has its own self-interest, but all those countries, including the United States, Japan, and South Korea, all have clear, justifiable reasons for preventing North Korea from doing anything insane. And so they're now beginning to all move in concert to do that for different reasons, but for the same goal.
Jacqueline is in Palo Alto, California, and she said David had a guest on the other day who put an awful lot of stock and emphasis into the Google Lunar X Prize competition,
yeah.
Who thinks that it's going to be really magnanimous for the commercial space and the lunar industry, also suggesting that maybe the launches at the end of 2017 will somehow get delayed and that this contest might be extended again.
Yeah.
I've not heard you talk much about Google Lunar X Prize. My hunch is it's not something that you're that interested in, but how do you see Google Lunar X Prize?
Oh, I follow it. I post on Behind the Black whenever there's an update. In fact, just what is it? Today is the 25th. On the 21st, I posted a story which talked about how there's five finalists right now.
Right, and there's an Israeli team, by the way.
Yeah, the Israeli team, that's one of the finalists. They've discovered they can no longer win the race because their contract with SpaceX, their SpaceX launch, is just not going to happen before the end of this year, and so they won't make the deadline. Whether they'll continue or not, a lot of these companies, even when they say, these competitors, even when they say they can no longer win, they say they're going to continue anyway because they have the investment and people see financial benefit for doing it. But so the article that I posted to then went down and reviewed all the finalists and what their statuses are. And it appears they all have some problems getting off the ground by the end of this year. For example, one of the competing companies has a contract with Rocket Lab.
In New Zealand, yeah.
Yeah, with their Electron rocket. But the trouble with that is that Rocket Lab said it would be going to be starting to do flight tests this year, like by February, March, and
good luck.
Now in almost May, and there hasn't been a launch.
And they've never launched.
I've talked to industry people who have told me that they don't think it's possible for them to get off the ground by this year. So they're looking at not getting off the ground. And,
and that's Moon Express. That's the inside track.
Yeah. And then you've got there's two companies, two different competitors, Japan and an Indian company, that are going to be piggybacking together on a Indian PSLV rocket, but the problem they have there, the Japanese company has a deal to just draw piggyback, but the Indian competitor is basically paying for the launch, it appears to me, based on the news stories, but they've got to raise $70 million to pay for it, and they haven't been able to do it yet. So then you got that problem as well. And so it looks like it's very likely that they might extend the deadline before the end of this year because they want someone to win. They're not going to give, awards to all of them for competing, but they do want a winner. And so, they've done this already before. They've delayed it three times in the past and twice before.
Yeah, and they delayed XPRIZE several times, too. So.
Exactly. So it's very likely it will get delayed again. All of these five finalists are reasonably close. So it's possible a one-year delay might actually be more than enough to get something to happen. I think there's a... Well, I shouldn't speak. Rocket Labs, you know, these companies, I follow them, and when nothing happens, I scratch my head. Well, what's going on? And I keep a very cold eye on this. I'm really enthused and want them to succeed, but I also keep a cold eye on it. If they're not doing anything, I'm going to say, wait a minute, this is not happening. And, you know, I got criticized by a bunch of people because I was always very critical of X-Corp. I just didn't see that company going anywhere. They didn't go anywhere.
Well, it went out of business for the Lynx.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, I wanted them to succeed, but what I was looking at was just did not ring like it was going to happen. And I'm now, when I see Rocket Lab say they're going to launch in January, they said, we hope to launch by February. And nothing happened.
Yeah, we're into May.
And nothing's happened. And so you sit and say, well, gee, I'm beginning to wonder here. Are they having serious engineering problem they can't solve? Are there investment money they don't have? And that I don't think is the case. They've raised money. So what is the issue there? You know, similarly, I took a tour. I posted it on Behind the Black. I got a local tour by the CEO of Vector, which is used to be called Vector Space Systems, but they dropped Space Systems.
Yeah, he's been on the show several times.
Yeah, Jim. Yes, in fact, basically, I got through to him in Tucson through you.
That's
and
right,
John
yeah.
Bachelor.
Uh-huh.
And so I emailed him, and he said, sure, I'll give you a tour. And we spent half a day together in his very small and not very impressive in size factory.
Jim Cantrell, yeah.
What they're doing. I was very impressed with it. I posted some pictures of it on Behind the Black. Well, they had a series of, they are planning a series of suborbital tests of their rocket, building towards the fifth suborbital flight will be like 90% to orbit, which means if they push it a little harder, they could get it into orbit. And the goal of those suborbital test flights is to just test them, is to do engineering tests of their various engineering that they need to put together to make this small rocket, orbital rocket, eventually fly. Well, when I went took a tour, they had in the factory there their first suborbital test rocket sitting on the factory floor. They were just finishing up some work on it. And they had, sitting on the factory floor as well, the dummy second stage. The second stage was just a dummy. It wasn't going to fire, but they wanted the weight on the rocket when they did the suborbital flight to get the aerodynamics and, you know, so forth and so on. And he said, and Jim Cantrell told me at that time, that they were planning to do a suborbital launch in just a week or so, out of Mojave. And so I posted on Behind the Black just this week because there was a story about the company, and buried in that story, there was no news about this test flight, buried in that story was the fact that they scrubbed the launch because of a sensor issue, and then when they fixed that, they discovered the winds were too high and they couldn't fly. So they just scrubbed it, they brought the rocket back, I guess, to Tucson, and they're probably going to fly it on their next, in May. Now, the May launch is supposedly going to happen in Georgia at the spaceport that state is trying to put together. I'm not sure that will be the case, but that's at least what's supposed to happen. Now, I bring that story up to say, you know, once again, I was very impressed with Vector, but they got to start flying.
Yeah.
And it makes it hard for them to raise the capital they need if they're not flying. It becomes a vicious cycle. You don't fly, you can't raise the capital. It makes it hard to fix the problems. You don't fly, you can't raise the capital. So they got to start flying.
You've got a caller on hold.
All right,
now,
let's talk.
Bob, do you want to guess the name of the caller?
I think it's SLS John.
My God, I can't believe you did it.
I did it. I'm
you,
right.
You, how did you guess SLS John? Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Because I know without any doubt that John wants to tell me that capitalism in space is invalid and it's inappropriate comparison and SLS is really God's gift to the universe. That's what I think John wants.
Hi, John. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hi, John.
How's it going? Well,
he guessed you.
You heard, I'm sure, John, I guess.
Yeah, he heard it all.
Yeah. Well, And I was thinking about that lady that called about the Korean rocket. I think what she was really questioning was the theory that's been put out in the media that we actually did something to cause that rocket to fail.
That's John, you're absolutely right. That's a second issue. I don't think she was specifically asking that. She was asking about missile technology to knock it down. That's my impression. But that's an interesting question. You know, that's all speculation. I will tell you from watching the track record of North Korea's launches, because every time they do a launch, it's missile technology, it's launch technology. I pay attention to it. My impression is that their aerospace industry, to build their missile industry, their missile technology, they are approaching this in the absolutely worst possible way. They are being dictated to by their leader, and so they have repeated failures because the goal isn't to figure out what was wrong. The goal is to have a successful stunt that the leader can show off to the world. And so when something goes wrong, they don't spend the time to figure out why. They rush to do another launch. And so I think that it's perfectly reasonable. We didn't have to do anything. This has happened repeatedly. They blow up on the launch pad. We could have done something, but I don't think we have to. I think they have serious technical problems and cultural problems within their system to make it very difficult for them to succeed.
Yeah, well, I don't think we launched an interceptor missile.
We didn't do that, no.
The other possibilities, I guess, would be some sort of a direct energy weapon or a computer hack of some sort.
Yeah, but once again, we're speculating, and I think that I always go to the simplest Occam's razor solution, which is I've watched their program consistently fail at every launch. Every launch has failed, and it's failed for technical reasons, and I don't think, no matter how much hacking we might be able to do, I don't think we're that good. And I think there's enough, they're isolated enough, it would be very difficult to get in there. I think the simplest solution is they're just not competent here, and they're not really, they don't have the right due diligence. Their totalitarian system with the crazy leader on the top doesn't allow them to do the due diligence necessary to fix these problems. And that's the simple solution. It doesn't mean we didn't, but I don't think so.
I thought somebody planned the story in the media, and then everybody carefully, the government said they wouldn't comment on it. which gave the impression that maybe they did.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the whole game of disinformation.
Warfare.
And you play that game, too, and I'm sure American intelligence services might be playing that game just as well. I'm focused here very much on what I think is just the simplest explanation for the failure.
I don't disagree. I just think they were playing a psychological game.
I don't disagree with you either. Oh, so we don't disagree. We're done. Thank you, John. It's a pleasure.
We can agree on that one. But, have you heard anything about issues that SpaceX faced or how easy the turnaround of that reusable rocket launch was? I mean, there was a lot of work done to get that.
It's pretty clear if you just, I was just following the step-by-step process. It was almost a year from the time it landed to the time they reused it. And so, and I think actually from an engineering perspective and a management perspective, for the first reuse of a first stage, that is a perfectly reasonable time. They tested the engines. They probably went through them with fine-tooth comb, because even though they were reusing it, the real goal here was an engineering test, and they wanted to find out what that first launch and landing did to the first stage and to the engines, so that they would have an understanding in future design and future engines and first stages what they need to do to make them more robust and more reusable. And at the same time, while they were doing that, trying to learn the engineering for future first stages, they were probably going through it very closely to see, well, they had a bunch of them, and they were going through all of them, and they picked this one because it probably wasn't the best condition, and they therefore the most likely work they did then, you know, static fire engine tests to make sure the engines were functioning well, and they were. You know, a lot of rocket engines are designed for very, for expendable rockets designed for very short lifespans. They have enough to do their first launch and, you know, maybe double or triple the amount of time, but to go launching, firing for years on end reusable, they don't make them that way. Well, I think SpaceX has tried to put more robustness into them so they can fire them for a long period of time. And they've tested that. There's no, this was pretty clear over that year they were doing those kind of things. They have said now, by the way, that they have about, what is it? They want to use 6 more used first stages in the next year. 2 of them are going to be on the Falcon Heavy demo launch. You know, the core stage is a new one, but the 2 side stages are going to be previously used stages. And their SES has already committed to flying again with a used stage, and I think they have 2 launches, so you could be you would count for 4 right there. I'm speculating, but they have said they want to reuse 6 in the next year. So that's almost their whole stock right now. And so they must have looked at all their their first stages and decided that they are mostly all usable again. Obviously, they're going to have additional launches where they're going to hopefully collect first stages. For example, the Dragon launch at the end of May is not using a reused first stage, so that first stage will land, hopefully, and should. They've been pretty reliable, and then that stage will be refurbished or at least checked out and then used again. And each stage, you know, they constantly are improving, so each stage, I'm sure, has got some modifications to make it function better and therefore be easier to prep for the next launch. That's my summary of where I think they're going with this, and I think they're in a very solid position. They're eventually going to be in a place where they have a fleet of first stages that they are just using over and over again. That's their goal, and then they can start selling first stages to other people. You build a second stage, and you attach it to our first stage. And then they're going to start selling some of their used first stages, and you'll have used first stage dealers, you know. Would you buy a first stage from this guy? That's going to be happening eventually, I think, and it's kind of cool when it does.
Yeah. I mean, it's an impressive success. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. It is historically important because it shifts the whole mindset of how rockets are built and designed. You can't think of them as something thrown away anymore. They are once again ships. We're shifting to that mode. Look, Blue Origin, when they announced, you know, they made a big press announcement with a video simulation of their New Glenn rocket. It's not here yet, but their engine is ready to be tested. You know, so it's getting, once the engine's there, you can then, the building the rest of the rocket is relatively trivial. The engine's the big thing. You build that first, and then you build the rocket around it, the stage around it. They've got the engine almost ready for static firing testing, and so when you're in that stage, they're getting close, and their simulation talked about the same thing, reusability, bringing those stages back, and I think this is going to become the way it's done in the next decade, and for the big rockets, and it's eventually going to be the way it's done with every rocket. And they might do it differently in terms of engineering, but they will be reusing the stages because they won't be able to compete otherwise.
How long do you think our progress has been set back for the fact that the mainstream, the previous historic companies didn't pursue this sort of technique earlier? In other words, I would think that that the computer technology of today was necessary to do what they're doing with the Falcon 9 right now. You couldn't have done this in the 60s, for instance, because it wasn't mature enough to actually control it that well.
You know, John, you could be right that there was certain reasons in terms of actual technology that made this not possible earlier. I won't say that's not possible. I think that is certainly a factor.
Well,
but I would say that
maybe what about the late 80s or early 90s?
Yeah, I would say that culturally the older launch companies could have done this sooner had they been interested in the slightest in being innovative with rockets, and they just were not. Now, granted, granted, it might have taken longer, it might have been more difficult, but then again, they might have also push-started some technology then that we're only getting now because no one was pushing for it. Once again, think about it. Space shuttle landed using computers. I mean, it could be flown in by the person, but they designed it from the start to use computers to land it in the late 70s. So in my mind, computer technology could have done this.
But there were no drivers for it. The government certainly wasn't pushing for it.
That's right.
So there was no interest.
And in fact, the only driver here that's going is that you had a person, Elon Musk, who was visionary enough to say, you know, let's do this. And he also had, he recognized because nobody else was doing it, he had an opportunity in terms of profit to do it because it puts him in the catbird seat in the aerospace launch industry. He's got the best chip and the cheapest chip and because he did this. And so he took advantage of the fact nobody else was. And in competition, you know, you go for it, you win. And so, I think your point is very well taken, John, that yes, I think that it would have been very hard to have done this, much harder to have done this 25, 30 years ago, but I don't think it was impossible, because I think that there was, you know, the space shuttle was pretty remarkable. It could land autonomously without people running it, and the Russians proved that with Buran. They flew a space shuttle that was unmanned and landed without on a runway without people on it. And the Russians did that, what, in the mid-80s. And so if you could land a shuttle glided into a runway accurately, well, then it says to me that there's a pretty good chance you could have also vertically landed a rocket as well. But, you know, I think that the technology certainly made it easier for SpaceX, the modern technology.
Right. Well, but then that suggests that, remember, there was a government interest in reusability, i.e. the shuttle. But as we know, they went with a different design concept. And I'm saying maybe instead of doing the shuttle as we did, we could have done something like a rocket stage, whether the Falcon 9 level or even bigger, and land it vertically and use that to launch a vehicle into space back, say, circa early 80s.
You're forgetting about the Delta Clipper. The Delta Clipper in the late 90s, right? Early 90s, excuse me. I actually forget where the financing came from. I'm not sure if it was Air Force or NASA, but the Delta Clipper to show vertical landing was possible, but it didn't go anywhere because it was a government-owned operation and it wasn't being done for profit purposes. And that is the fundamental problem. That was the fundamental problem for the shuttle as well. They weren't doing it with profit in mind, which means you've got to keep the cost down, you've got to do it efficiently. They were doing it just to prove it could be done, but because they were doing it that way, they were very inefficient in the cost. So if they had decided, all right, the concept we're going to use is vertically landing the first stage, I guarantee you it still would have been as expensive and as inefficient because the goal was not to make money and be profitable. They were using tax dollars. They had no budget limit, essentially. They could get a much bigger budget, and the budget wasn't determined by profit loss. It was determined by politics in Congress. And the congressional politics is, hey, we want to bring pork into our district so that we can hire a lot of people and say we're hiring people. And that's not how a profitable company functions. So, yeah, we maybe could have done it with the shuttle. Look, NASA's original concepts for the shuttle were actually trying to lower the cost. The people that were doing it, the original designers, they came from a different time. They understood profit loss, even if they were working for the government. They realized that if we can do this inexpensively, we will help fuel the settlement of the solar system by Americans. But they couldn't build the concept they originally had because the politics in Congress required them to compromise and to basically change their design. So it was no longer cost effective. So, you know, we've had this discussion before, John. It always comes back in my mind to what the fundamentals behind why the thing is built. And if it's being built for a government project, and government's building it, there's no motive to be efficient. If it's being built by a private company to sell a product that is affordable to its customers, you're going to get a completely different result that's more successful, and I think that's been proven right now.
Anything else?
One last thing. Do you think, on the thing on Trump, do you really think that he was just joking about the Mars thing, or do you think he really didn't realize the actual state of our space program versus Mars?
I don't know. But in looking at the transcripts and the descriptions of the conversation, it looked to me pretty clearly that he was joking around, having fun, and knowing that doing that is going to get him a lot of press. Whether he knows specifically, I don't know. But I will say everything so far I've noticed about what his administration so far is doing is that when they actually start doing some things, they don't go off half-cocked. They've thought it out somewhat. And so if the time comes and they're going to actually try to do something, in NASA, and he decides he's going to make an announcement, we're going to put together a program to go to the moon, let's say, do a Kennedy-like speech again, he will not be so, it won't be so absurd, I'm sure of that.
Well,
so that's why
it's not staffed. It's a staff work problem if it happened. But anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up. I like that last thing, that joke he had about she was trying to work on a process to turn urine into drinking water, and he said, better you than me.
Yeah, he's having fun. And
he's having fun with the astronauts.
This is why I don't take this too seriously. He's having fun with the astronauts, and he knows he's having fun with the press. He knows there are people out there that he says something a little bit absurd, they are going to go bonkers. And he enjoys that because it not only gives him press, it helps him influence policy, actually. He gets people to pay attention. In a sense, from NASA's perspective, he's illustrating that he's really interested in space, and he wants to do something. He just hasn't decided what yet. And there is negotiations, I know, going on within the Trump administration on what their policy should be, and they have not come to a decision yet. It's very clear to me. And the NASA administrator is probably going to be, whoever they choose, is going to probably be a key player in what those final decisions are.
Okay, well, I'll clear the line and see who else wants to call in.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, as
always. Listeners, we are going to pause for 3 minutes because we're way beyond the halfway point, and we're going to take a break. So the toll-free number, if somebody else out there wants to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere, and remember, we do answer the phone while we're on break. Back in three.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Bob Zimmerman special on Tuesday night, and we do have a couple of sponsors. They have not yet bolted on us. So that means Bob is behaving. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is a great sponsor, and they have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They're busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science, engineering, technology, and they increase our knowledge of the universe and do help us bring the world closer together. Check them out at AIAA.org. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense tech. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then, of course, Celestis is our sponsor, and they have the Celestis DNA program now. Remember, since 97, they are the premier memorial spaceflight company around the world. And they have this new DNA plan, and, you know, in the past, if you wanted to send your loved one who had passed away to space, you sent them a gram of ashes or something of that nature. Well, now your loved one may have a traditional burial, and you can send DNA for going to space. Plus, you can include your own DNA, and your DNA and your loved one who's passed away's DNA can go on the same joyride into the cosmos together, which is pretty damn cool, if you ask me. So this is a great new service, and if you go to their website, Celestis.com, you can get a lot more information about it and about their memorial space flights in general. Again, for the sake of full disclosure, I am a Celestis customer. I have done multiple flights with them, with my dogs and my mom. I absolutely love the company. I believe my comments are at arm's length. But I think they're one of the finest businesses I've ever dealt with in my entire life. I love the people, and I hope I don't have to use them anytime soon, but I would absolutely do business with them again. And Charles Lurio, Dr. Lurio of the Lurio Report, is our caller, ready to go to bat with Bob Zimmerman. Hi, Charles. Welcome back to the show. What's on your mind tonight, my friend?
Well, a little bit earlier, Bob and Mr. SLS were talking about the entry issue for recovering a vertical landing stage and all that, and whether the computation capability was there a while ago. And you brought up the shuttle and the Soviet Iran. Now, actually, that's really not the same problem, because they were coming in, belly first,
yeah,
and unpowered, and the key thing with the vertical landing is, well, it's coming down vertically. It's a very different geometry, and they're doing a supersonic entry firing.
Sure.
And so it turns out that there was a good article about a month or two ago that talked about how they were computing like crazy to get the damn thing down on the SpaceX thing.
Yeah, I mean, John's point was well taken. It's very possible that, yes, the technology wasn't quite ready until maybe a decade or so ago, and SpaceX took advantage of the available new computer technology to do it. I don't deny that, Charles, but I also think that the launch industry was incredibly uninterested in innovation for decades, and
I couldn't agree with you more on that.
In my mind, there was definitely the possibility that they missed the boat earlier, that they could have done things they didn't do, not because of technology, but because of culture. So I'm not disagreeing with you, though. Technology here has to advance in certain ways to make such things possible, but you know, I watched them for years say this was going to be impossible. We don't even.
Oh, I know. I heard the same.
Yeah. So we're in agreement here. I mean, there's no disagreement. And I agree that, you know, shuttle's trying to do a very different kind of thing, but that they did do it with computers, says...
Oh, yeah, I mean, but basically you're coming in with a very different problem.
Well, Right, but you know, that's a different engine, so it's just, you know, that's just a new parameters you've got to deal with. And if you have the, if you're being innovative and creative, well then, hey, let's make it work. I should point out, once again, that, the Viking landers on Mars landed vertically on Mars.
Right.
You know, and they were robots. So and so did surveyors on the moon. So the point is, we did have the technology to vertically land something. Now, granted, once again, the problem is much more difficult. All I'm saying is that
it's called atmosphere, Bob.
It's both. That's all. You know, there's a question in both cases. They should have been more innovative. Being innovative might not have made it possible, but they were definitely not innovative enough.
I absolutely agree with that, but I don't think you can take those other examples directly either.
Right.
But anyway, as far as the, just to switch to something else here, you mentioned vector space, or vector as they're now called.
Yeah.
Vector, everybody wants to have a single word title now, like planet.
Right. I think Vector Space Systems is actually a better name, to be honest. But that's,
I agree.
You know, even Planet Lab was a better name than just
the
Planet.
The fewer syllables, the better, according to the PR people.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't have a great deal of love for PR people.
Well, yeah, same here. But nonetheless, as far as the next launch attempt, it is going to be back out at Mojave.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Actually, it's... they're out at the far site. The Friends of Amateur Rocketry is where they're flying from.
Uh-huh.
And that's I don't know how far that is from Mojave proper. But anyway, the point is, what's his name?
Jim Cantrell,
yeah.
Yeah, I've been exchanging some notes with him recently because I was writing up something about them, and he said, well, we have, in order to recycle, to fly from that spot in California, the time it took to recycle with the FAA was, ended up us having our next opportunity on the 3rd of May.
Okay.
So, and then, so far as I can tell, it's the next flight after that.
That's in Georgia.
Fly from Camden in Georgia.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, does not yet have its spaceport license, so they're flying on a waiver.
Yeah. Yes, I've read about that as well. Right.
Right.
You know, once again, I think that's a really cool company, and I think that they have taken a very smart approach. It's a very risky business, and so a lot of companies aren't going to succeed, but we're starting to have a lot of companies trying to succeed, which means some of them are
right.
going to succeed. You know, and they're getting investment capital, much more successful in getting capital than I've ever seen before. You know, and you probably are much more in touch with that than I am, but my impression is that there's a lot more capital flowing to companies.
I have seen certain document that was reported about in the press recently from a major financial organization.
Yeah.
Can you get it yet, Bob?
Well, go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, you know, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's saying there's money involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some of the statements in that are amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, but that's my. I was now just talking about my impression of the industry itself and the company, the number of companies who are getting capital, without even doing any analysis.
Well,
like,
I mean,
so, you know, it's there. It's very
what's amazing is even more, in a sense, even more amazing to me was that you have, such a. A company at the heart of the financial system,
and
the government, you know, saying things that, you know, like, I mean, you would have, any of us might have been laughed out of the house.
Yes.
Just a few years ago.
Yes.
And it's like they're playing our song.
Yes.
It's even more so than it's been reported in some of the in the single official press story.
I think that it's an interesting thing. We all, David, you remember this, and Charles, you remember this, but when Spaceship One was flying, there was, even if it flew, the concept of private space doing any of this kind of stuff was like, as you say, you'd be laughed out of the house if you proposed it. They thought you were wacky.
Absolutely.
And they called me wacky. They called, I'm sure, you wacky. And David, I'm sure that you got the same kind of responses. And I've been saying that we've all been saying that this is the right way to go, and the success of SpaceX and Orbital Science, Orbital ATK, has really suddenly opened the floodgates for a lot of other private businesses, because they suddenly realize, you know, yeah, this works, this can happen. And so the future is very bright right now, because with competition here, you've got multiple redundant companies trying different approaches and all trying to do it more cost effectively. And so it's the future for the United States in space is incredibly bright, and it's so bright that it's going to wipe the floor of every other nation in the world eventually if this keeps going. If we don't have some other disaster.
Yeah, no, things can always happen, but it looks pretty damn good right now.
Let's come back to Trump. What his policy is going to be could be, in my mind, it's somewhat irrelevant. I will say that. If he does what every president has done in the last 50 years, he could have some influence, both positive or either positive or negative. But I don't think at this stage, if he doesn't do anything really original, he's going to have significant impact. If he does something like I proposed, you know, try to get the Outer Space Treaty changed so we can claim territory, he could then really do something significant and positively significant.
Right. Well, there's
but I don't think he's going to do that. I think he's not going to make that much difference.
Maneuvers being talked about there, in particular that having Luxembourg, I don't know if you saw this piece, that having Luxembourg, which is a threat to no one, make the suggestion to the UN,
right,
in a sense, makes it easier to start the ball rolling.
Yeah, well, you may not have been listening at the start of the show. I talked about that at length. I've talked about it behind the black. I mean, yeah, Luxembourg proposing now that they're going to demand a revision to the, or a rewrite of the Outer Space Treaty. That's a really significant step, because you're right. It gets the ball rolling. They're not a threat to other people. But at the same time, it means others will have to address the question. And it's no doubt about this, that there are people in Congress and in the executive branch, you know, not even people who came with Trump, but people who were there just from administration to administration, who have recognized this issue and would like it addressed.
Yeah.
And Luxembourg addressing it allows them to push. So it's a very positive development. Once again, the future is bright, because if that happens, it once again is to the United States' advantage and the free, you know, the private enterprise part of the world.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you brought up the hearing tomorrow.
No, I haven't brought that up. The hearing tomorrow is just not interesting to me, because they didn't invite me to do it, be part of it. So I don't care.
I have. I'm not. Yeah, usually such things I am not. Terribly interested in, but it might or might not have some significance as we go along.
You know what's significant about it? This is a hearing that Ted Cruz is trying to put together. Significant about it is what I said earlier, which is that everybody in Washington and in the aerospace industry is trying to influence Trump in what his policy is going to. And this is actually Ted Cruz, I think, throwing his two cents in the hopper.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, because we hear one thing. Things have remained so ambiguous for quite a period of time now. Not that that's unprecedented, but in terms of, you know, having a NASA administrator or whatever. but in terms of the policy fight, you know, these guys at some level are still having it out.
Let's go back to the Obama administration as an example, and I could go back to the Bush administration as well. In both cases, it was about a year plus before the new administrator was picked.
Well,
you know, and the policies themselves from those presidents was, especially with Obama, there was no clear policy for him at all for years, and that the policy that eventually evolved not from the president, but from people within NASA having
actually
this two-pronged
approach.
And I think with George Bush it was similar, that he didn't really know what he wanted to do, and then eventually after the Columbia accident, his hand was forced, and he basically used recommendations from the Columbia accident and other people to come up with his vision for space. But he didn't really know what he wanted to do, and
well,
I think Trump is no different.
Griffin, that plan was a lot better at the beginning than it was later on.
You're talking about Bush's?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, his proposal sounded good at the start, but he was asking, and this is my complaint when he did it, I didn't have a website yet, I wrote some UPI columns about this, but my complaint at the time was this is supposed to be a conservative president, but he's basically decided to do it as a Soviet-style top-down government program, and it's not going to be very effective. I was in favor of it because I wanted space. At the time, I just wanted space still, but I also recognized that asking NASA to do it in this manner is probably not going to be
within that context. The architecture was hijacked by Griffin to be, you know, basically the pork architecture rather than the create capabilities architecture.
Well, you people like to say it was hijacked by Griffin, but I got to tell you, the natural politics of the government in the 21st century means that no matter who is going to be in charge,
the flow of the river
is hijacked by
the
politics
direction.
Of pork.
There's no question about that.
It's happening with SLS and Orion, and it would happen with any big government project that Trump proposes. If you don't allow it to be built by privately owned companies that will own what they build, you're going to end up with pork, and that's what we got. And so I'm not, you know, to me, I'm not particularly outraged or bothered by the lack of policy from the Trump administration, because no president, pretty much in our entire lives, in the last half century, has ever come, no president, period, I take that back, never has come into office with a clear idea of what they want to do in space. Every single, I could go down the list.
Well, space is
unimportant
as people say. So, but anyway,
tell me, Charles, what did you think of capitalism in space? I'd love to hear your thoughts on what I said in that paper.
Talk about that later.
What?
We can talk about that
later. We're on the air. Let's talk about it now. We only have
no. I don't want
to
talk.
I'm going to say I got to go to bed. David, you got a comment wanting me to comment on the response to
well,
it.
Well, yeah, let's see if
faces column. And I wrote on Behind the Black how really the negative op-eds responding to capitalism in space routinely claimed I had incorrect facts, factual errors in my report, but then never pointed out any of the factual errors. And I could point out factual errors because there were some editing problems. But they didn't. All they basically did is whine that this is not a valid comparison.
Bob.
The bottom line here is that the government model that we've been following since the 60s is at this time and for the last probably 30 years has been a failure, and it has been a failure at providing the American people with access to space. And for that and it's cost us a lot of money not providing us access to space.
Okay.
So we need a different model, and we have another model that is actually successfully providing us access to space for very little money at the same time, and I think that's incredibly valid. And the only reason people are protesting it is the people that are protesting me or telling me it's incorrect are basically members of the bubble in Washington who are basically trying to protect their financial intellectual interests. You know, there's a lot of people who get money from the faucet of government spending, such as Esalas and Orion, and they're very afraid they're going to lose that.
Well, wait a minute. I'm going to jump in here.
Go ahead.
Because I really totally disagree with you, Bob, because I read Pace's article.
Yeah.
And I actually know Scott, although I've never talked to him about this, although he's going to be on the show May 25th or 26th.
Sure.
Anyway, my take on his critique was that he did not approve, maybe that's too strong a word, he found fault with your research methodology and made a point that you were attempting to compare dissimilar things to one another, and when you do that, such comparisons are inaccurate. He agreed with you that SLS and Orion were ghostly over costing and all of that crap. And he also said, and I'm not qualified to really say one way or another, that you misunderstood or misapplied some of the lessons of public-private partnership regarding COTS and what really happened with COTS, because he was there at the time the COTS program was going down. And he made a big point of how you have to compare like things to be able to come up with analysis that is relevant, and that you compared across lines. It would be like comparing a human to a spider. You cross lines. Now, you can disagree with that.
I do. Wait a minute.
That
is the argument that a lot of the big space industry people made in criticizing the paper.
They didn't.
I inserted an entire section into the paper pointing out their position so that people can understand why they think this comparison is invalid, and then explained why I think it is valid. And part of the reason I think it's valid is that, one, they overstate the distinction between, when you come to capsules especially, they overstate the distinction between Orion and Dragon and Starliner by magnitudes of overstatement. They try to claim things of Orion that are just simply not true. And secondly, the bottom line here is that this is supposed to be providing us access to space, and we're spending a gigantic amount of money and not accomplishing it. We are now reality that it will be 20 years since George Bush proposed the Crew Exploration Vehicle before the first manned mission will launch. It's going to take NASA 20 years to do a single manned mission and cost more than $40 billion. That is not providing us access.
Okay, so stop.
There's something corrupt there. And meanwhile, private companies are getting things off the ground and launching.
Okay, Bob, slow down.
More of the money.
Bob.
That's a valid comparison.
Bob, I understand that you will and need and should defend your work.
I'm going to.
But, then that's fine. But for people who have a different perspective and a different way of analyzing and a different thing, it doesn't make them wrong. What I wish would happen is that somehow there would be a forum where you and Scott or other people that have opined on these subjects and have differences could go into a real honest-to-God legitimate exchange of ideas and debates, because what happens is you call everybody wrong and you're right. They call your comparisons and your analysis methodology. I can't even
talk. They call it wrong.
They call it incorrect.
Right.
And the people who don't know their butts from their butts don't know whether you're on the right track or they're on the right track, or it's he said, she said, and Title IX is at work and you're going to be expelled from the new space community or, you know, whatever. So the problem that I have with all of this is because I air all ideas, and I'm fine with airing all ideas as long as civility is practiced by the people.
Right.
But I can't put you and Scott Pace or Joe Blow or whoever else has these opinions in front of each other and benefit the people that you want to reach. And that's, I feel really bad about that, because I think that there is a message here and there is information that could benefit the community and policymakers, especially those that are not totally expert and experiential in this entire field that we're talking about. And we can't, I can't meld you guys together where you can thrash it out rather than saying he said, she said. So that's what kind of pisses me off about the whole thing. I think that you and Scott, or you talk about Eric as another one who, but he wasn't as bad about it as what Scott was.
Eric,
I think,
Berger, Eric Berger was actually pretty supportive.
Yeah, I think you guys should come together in a forum. I wish I could put that forum together on the space show. Now, Scott will be on the show, but I assume if you called and took up 15 minutes of the call on, well, I'm just saying if you did, I don't think you guys would have a constructive debate. I mean, I guarantee it would be civil and polite, and everybody would be friendly and courteous. There's not a doubt in my mind about any of that. I just don't think it would lead to the expectation I would have of wanting to put you and others who disagree with your work and your findings into a forum that would benefit other people. And that's really what I would like to see happen.
I'll tell you this, David. Here's my thoughts on your point. You're right. We can't all get together and hold hands and do kumbaya.
Kumbaya,
that's
right.
Fundamental disagreement about this issue between me and others. And I'm not alone, by the way, in my position.
No, I understand that.
Let me finish the point. Just to say, I think that in the free marketplace of ideas, I've made my points, I've expressed them, they've gotten published, they're out there for people to read. Scott has made his point, others have made their points in criticism of what I've said, I've responded. That is the free market of debate. Third parties, less or more knowledgeable about this issue, that are interested in it, will read both, and they can come to their own conclusions. I personally have no fear that they will, in the end, favor where I stand.
And see,
but if they don't because they think my methodology is wrong or the comparison is invalid, well, that's fine. I accept the reality of free speech, and I will. I can take that. But I think the debate is out there openly, and I don't have any problem. In fact, I welcome Scott's op-eds and the criticism, because I think it's important to discuss it. And you know,
I just wish I just wish you guys would go head to head, or somebody else.
The opportunity hasn't been offered to me.
Well, I don't know.
I'm not sure it could be productive, but it would probably be basically me saying my position and him saying his, and I'm not sure we'd get anywhere.
Well,
and that's okay. I don't have a problem.
I don't know, but you guys would have to make room for everybody to talk, and that's,
well,
that's
we need a lot of time because we both
because and it's hard to talk over you to get you to stop, even though you're not using a cell phone. Once you get going, but I think it is an important enough topic that all of this should be aired, and I would love to see it. I'll tell you the best place to air it is really, as much as I would love to do it on the space show, but it would be at a conference on a panel like an ISDC or Space Frontier Foundation, or, you know, with an audience that could ask you questions, and you'd both, you know, be on the stage and you could interactive and respond with one another.
I doubt seriously almost any space conference would want me to show up, because they usually,
well, you've been to them before.
The people,
come on, I
they
met
don't
you.
Want me there.
I met you at a space. I met you at an ISDC conference.
I was there as a paid member of the NSS when we met. I was not there as a speaker invited to a panel. I wasn't even on any panels. And I ran one panel that had two people come to hear what going on, the law in space. That was how little interest there was in outer space treaty.
Well, New Space would probably be interested in having you come, but I don't know that Scott would come.
Yeah, so, you know, but I wouldn't have any problem debating these issues, because I think right now the bottom line, as I said to you before, earlier, is that the federal government has been given the task of providing the American people access to space, and the attempt, the government way of doing it from NASA has been an abject failure. That they announced they're going to delay, the IG report that came out just 2 weeks ago that said SLS and Orion have many problems and they're not going to launch as scheduled. And I've known that was going to come out for now almost a year. I've been following very closely, and they've been leaking, and there have been hints of the delays, and there's no question in my mind that they will not launch that first manned flight. It'll take 20 years for them to do that.
Well, I don't know that it'll take 20 years, but
it's disgraceful.
It's going to be delayed, but I'll bet SpaceX delays their flight, too.
Well, they will, but it won't take them 20 years to get their first flight.
Okay, you have another question.
Laura, is Charles still here?
I took him off the line to clear the line, because he wasn't saying anything. So if Charles has something more to say, you're welcome to call back, but I wanted to clear it in case somebody wanted to get in before we end in a few minutes. And it is 866, everybody, 687-7223, but you have an email from your friend in Huntsville, Tim. Who we haven't heard from yet tonight, so we're hearing from him. What does Bob know about privately funded science and research? I sent him a link to the Planets Foundation, which is a non-government organization trying to build a telescope. Well, I got an email from them, too. They wanted me to promote their Kickstarter on the air, and I wouldn't do it. Was trying to build a telescope to imagine nearby exoplanets. What is his opinion on it and other like ventures? And, Tim, I invited him to call an open line show, which he says he will do, but I don't promote other people's crowdfunding programs on the space
show.
Yeah, well, and there's so many of them now that it would turn the show into an infomercial.
Okay. Well, I will say this. You know, this, we talked about the Google XPRIZE earlier.
Right.
I think that there is a there is potential here for private enterprise in this area. There is potential. If the costs for launch drop, and then it becomes more, and once again, as I've said many times over the years, when the costs drop, the customer base grows.
Which
then allows new people to come in, which allows the launch industry to grow, which lowers the cost, which brings in more customers, et cetera, et cetera. And this is actually a evidence of exactly that process happening. You're beginning to get projects being proposed that would never have been proposed a decade and a half ago because there was no way to get them launched. But now there's people are realizing, oh, you know, we might be able to afford the launch, and so let's make it happen. And the Google XPRIZE is demonstrating that, because they might not get it done this year, but they have opportunities to get into space at a reasonable cost, and they have contracts to get the launch contracts. And so I think those privately funded and built lunar rovers are going to fly. One of them, at least, is going to fly eventually. And so, yes, I think this is a viable future issue. Once again, scientists are a customer. They have needs to do research. If they can raise the money from a number of different sources, then they need to buy the product somewhere. And if they can, for example, buy space on a Red Dragon going to Mars to do their research, and it's cost-effective for them, well, they'll do it. And therefore, SpaceX is making money, and they're getting what they need done. And so, yeah, I think this is an opportunity for the whole industry down the road. It will happen. But it's a little different, because a lot of the science research is not for profit. It's for research. And so it's a little different. But, yeah, there's money to be made there, and I think it's going to happen eventually.
Okay, you got a caller on hold. And Doug in Southern California says someone else is waiting on the line. Well, I got rid of Lurio, so I don't know who was waiting on the line, but it just rang, Doug, so I don't know if that's you or not. Anyway, he says, I think that Scott and Robert on the show at the same time would be good. Competing op-eds don't allow for direct response to specific objections of the other sides. In other words, one could read both articles and still be uncertain about which side one agrees with when the issues are all mixed within an article. Likewise, with a debate, it would be best to break the issues down into components and then give a bit of time for both sides to address each subcomponent with no interruption allowed. My two cents. cents worth. Okay.
That's a good idea.
All right. Let's see who your last caller of the night is. Because I have to get ready for George.
Yeah, I know. I know. Tell George hello. You know, I'm supposed to be their science advisor, but they go with other people a lot of times.
Well, yeah, and you've done lately many more co-shows than I've done.
Yeah. I'll go for it.
So you know the routine as well as I do. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. And who are you at the 11th hour?
Yes, John in Redding. I almost forgot you guys were on the night. Sorry about that.
Okay, go for it, John. And
yeah, just for Bob, Robert. If he's heading up to Idaho Falls, there's going to be a lot of people there. Have you thought about making speaking on Sunday night?
Well, listeners can understand, what John is talking about is on August 20th,
the solar eclipse.
21st, yeah. The solar eclipse that's crossing the country. And I have a reservation at a hotel up in Idaho Falls that night. My wife and I are going to spend a week in Glacier. But on the way, timed it to see the solar eclipse. I've never seen a live solar eclipse, and I thought this was an opportunity. I'm not going to miss it. It might be cloudy, but at least I can go to my deathbed saying, I tried. So I'm going to be there, but nobody's asked me. If someone was to ask me, we're going up Saturday the day before. Sunday the day before.
Going up to the Glacier, so you'd be just driving through down 20, huh?
Well, no, we're coming in the night before. We're staying at a hotel so that the next day in the morning we'll be there in Idaho Falls, and then, after the eclipse, we'll drive on to Glacier. And so if someone wanted me to give a talk Sunday night somewhere in Idaho Falls, I'd be glad to do it. Of course, I have a long drive, so it's going to have to be worked out. I haven't been asked.
Are you
in Idaho Falls? You want
to? No, he's in Northern California.
Yeah, so you're not in the
place. Right, but I'm going to be there, yeah.
I don't know anyone in Idaho Falls to even suggest such a thing. So,
I can find out anybody. I know a few people.
We can talk. Absolutely, I'd be willing.
Okay, cool. I'll see what I can find out and maybe catch up on the next one of these or make a comment on
If you need to get a hold of me, email David. He'll put you in touch with me.
Right. That sounds good. Thanks, David.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks, John.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Wind it up, Bob. What should we look for the second half of the year?
Well, right now, we talk about SpaceX, and SpaceX has got stuff coming along. And, right now we're in an increasingly exciting situation because I've been talking about we've been in a transition mode for almost a decade, and the transition is beginning to fade away, and we can actually move into actual flight. And so, for example, Blue Origin, their new Shepard rocket, but Bezos has said that their flight program is delayed because he's got issues, and he wants to make sure those issues are dealt with engineering-wise before they fly, and so they've delayed. He's pretty straightforward about that kind of stuff, but we watch for that. And you've got, of course, SpaceX with the reusable Dragon capsule, the Falcon Heavy launch. They're prepping the core stage for its first static fire test. And what I've read is that they discovered that strapping three first stages together was a lot more complicated than they expected, and they had to do major redesign to the center core. And so that center core is going to be tested very shortly, and that's prepping for a demo launch later this year. And that's a big deal. You've got actually India's going to do another flight of its geosynchronous launch vehicle, GSLV, and that's a big deal because they have been ramping up their effort aggressively to gain market share. And you've got China there right now testing and docking and testing refueling of their unmanned freighter that's going to supply their full-sized space station when they launch it in 2020. Well, they've got it up there docked to their prototype station, and they're testing refueling and docking technologies with that right now. So there's movement going on there. And then Russia, the question is, what's going to happen with Russia? Russia's got serious problems with the space program, and I don't know what's going to happen with it. They have very serious engineering quality control problems. They have economic problems, and they have made from my perspective, the absolutely wrong choices by going back to a Soviet model. And they've never allowed competition to really function in Russia, and because of that, there's no incentive for the companies that exist to do better work.
And so what instead happens is a lot of corruption and a lot of bad engineering. And they're paying for it right now. This is likely for Russia going to be the fewest launches in a year, maybe since Sputnik, since the early 60s. They have not practically launched anything so far because of the problems they have with the engineering problems with the engines for both the Proton and the Soyuz. And they hope to, they say they're going to have lots of launches before the end of the year, but they're still not launching and they have serious problems. And whether they can fix those problems is questionable right now, I have to say. So, I mean, I could go down the list. We have a lot going on. I'm going to be, you know, as always, I post on Behind the Black and keep track of what's
going on.
No,
I need to get you back on the schedule because I'm filling up really rapidly already.
Do we have something scheduled after this show?
No. So, probably
on,
to...
You know, let's schedule some stuff.
Yeah, I won't. I won't.
It's going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'll send you through third quarter in the morning.
Okay, very good.
And and then you can let me know. And if you want to go later in the year, all of those dates are open. I just haven't started working the dates yet.
Yeah. So I mean, I have been told that SpaceX is going to invite me to the Falcon Heavy launch as a guest. I'm looking forward to that. Very, very, very much. That will be really a thrill.
Gwen is coming back on the show June 5th, so I'm really looking forward to
that. Yeah, that's a company that knows how to, knows the importance of talking
They're
to
good
the
people, yeah, absolutely.
And they do it well.
Okay, Zimmerman, new schedule. I'm making a note to myself.
Okay.
Anything new with the bats, real quick?
It's only the fungus is being found in increasingly more places in the United States.
Well, that's
it's
not
essentially,
nice.
And there's nothing that anyone can do about it. The bats spread it, and so eventually it's going to spread. The bottom line, though, is that it will not kill all the bats because of several reasons. One, Darwin works. They're eventually starting to recover in the east very slowly, and in the west, if they don't have to hibernate, they won't die because what the fungus does is it makes them have to go out in the winter months when there's no food and they starve to death.
So if it's milder, like in the West, they can probably get by without hibernating.
They do. There's a lot of bats in the West that do hibernate, but if they are forced to fly out in this winter time, what they will almost certainly at that point do is they will drop down to lower elevations where it's warmer and there will be bugs to eat. And so the impact will be not as great.
Will be not as great.
But there's not much we can do. There's a lot of science research going on that's trying to figure out what caused the bat fungus that's killing the bats. And they might actually be coming upon some interesting possibilities for curing the bats. But this is very far in the future. But it's just interesting. What they're doing is they're learning a great deal about biology and immunology with bats, which can maybe apply to us down the road.
Well, we're rooting for the bats on the space show.
Well, good. So I don't want you to root for
that. We're friends of the bats.
Me too.
All right, listen, look for my schedule in the morning, and I'll let you know when we're up and running with this program on the archives. And
say hello to George and Tom for me.
Will do, and I will talk to you soon and look forward to it.
Thanks.
And if a debate can be arranged, I'll see about doing it. We'll get Lurie on a moderated. How's that?
I would think you'd moderate it. But nothing against George, Charles, but I would think you'd do it if you were setting it up.
No, I would do it, but I'm just kidding around.
Oh, okay.
I
thought that the Doug in Southern Arizona suggestion.
Southern California.
In California, I think.
Yeah, he's
a very good
Southern
suggestion.
California.
Set it up with areas of discussion, and we discuss it, you know, like an area.
Well,
Orion versus Dragon Starlight.
Might do it as a webinar. See if Scott would do it as a webinar. I might get some, you know, more than just you and Scott. I might try to do it with four people.
Okay.
And that would kind of balance it a little bit and not make it so confrontational.
Oh, come on. That's the best thought. I mean, I don't mean that negatively, like we're fighting it out, but I think be much more vibrant. I think it would be more vibrant and maybe more interesting, and maybe you could get more from it if it's just two. You bring too much. Well, I don't like a lot of panel discussions in a lot of these conferences because you have too many people, and so no one ever gets a chance to really
express their perspective in detail.
Well,
Scott could express his it's better for him to be able to express his thoughts in detail, and such the same with me, and we could really hash it out, and we might find lots of areas of agreement, and we might find lots of areas of strong disagreement, but you know what, that's okay too. Then people will at least hear us in detail, and then we'll have a better idea of where they want to go.
Well, I will see. I need to contact Scott about his upcoming show anyway, because it's 3 days after my dental surgery, and it's Memorial Day weekend, and I'm thinking maybe the safer thing would be to delay him a couple of days, because over Memorial Day is probably not a great time anyway. And let's see if he would be interested. I have no clue if he would be interested or not.
Okay.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much. Have a good rest of the evening, and keep hoping for the bats.
You said it, David, and at Astros.
See you later. Okay. Listeners, thank all of you who called. Thank those of you who emailed us. Thank Bob Zimmerman for coming back on the show. His program, his paper, is on the Space Show in several places, Capitalism in Space. But you can Google that and find it. If you have not yet read it, I urge you to read it, and you're really missing out if you do not read it. This is something you should read and probably print out. And again, if you can't find it, email me and I'll be glad to send you the links.
It's on Behind the Black. Just go to Behind the Black and look at the top menu where it says books, and just click on that and you'll see the link to it.
And you'll
download it right there.
Absolutely. Bob, thank you again. Everybody, good night. Have a great week on the Space Show. Back again, Hotel Mars tomorrow, and Friday and Sunday. Good night, everybody.